Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shack of a sauce bottle, mate.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Mark Kenny and this is Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. Thanks for some very kind comments after our two recent episodes hinging off the ABC's excellent Nemesis series, and a shout out to Mark Willacy, the journalist at the microphone in that excellent series, and to the team. It was an extremely rigorous process. I think they did 90 research interviews, they did 60 on-camera interviews, and there was a lot of research involved. Of course, a big team, and I think it was a really splendid document. It didn't do everything, but those kinds of studies of what it was like inside the room, that's what they're intended to do, is tell us what was happening inside the government at the time, what were the political discussions that were happening, who was loyal to who wasn't, and so forth. It didn't try and unpick every political scandal that happened. It didn't try and get into the details of policy. And that did frustrate some people because, of course, there were some big policy arguments and failures pursued through that time by the various iterations of the coalition government. But I think you can only do so much. And this was much more a documentary about what was happening inside the coalition party room through leadership changes and through various other crises that befell that government. And I think it was outstanding. So a shout out to them and thanks for the enthusiasm we got from you as listeners. Now, this week, we're going to talk about the Middle East. A few days from now, the war in Ukraine will turn 2 years old. But where that conflict is seen in quite clear terms, the war between Israel and Gaza is more complex, it's more contested, it's certainly more polarizing. And I'd say for the West, it is also quite compromising, which is to say that the values that are being defended very clearly and strongly by Western countries in support for Ukraine are much more muddied when it comes to some of the things that are going on in Gaza, particularly the pulverizing attacks on civilians and the very, very worrying death toll there. And that's not to minimize at all the appalling circumstances in which this whole episode, this whole chapter of this ongoing conflict between Palestine and Israel, or Palestinians, stateless Palestinians, at least in a technical sense at the moment, and Israel has been going on for 75 years. But we know what happened on October 7, and we don't seek to minimize that in any way. To help us understand all of this a bit better, I'm very grateful to have with me one of Australia's foremost specialists on the Middle East, Ian Parmeter. Ian is a former ambassador to Beirut. He's had postings in Syria and Saudi Arabia, among others. He's a former intelligence analyst with the Office of National Assessments, and he is now a research scholar at the ANU's Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies. Welcome to Democracy Sausage, Ian.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Now, if it's all right with you, I might just start with, I gave a little potted history there of your background, but I might just start with your own story. You've had a very long association with the Middle East.
Yes, and I think like the associations that many people have with an area like that, it happened initially almost by accident, because I actually was a journalist for 5 years after leaving.
Oh, I didn't know that.
After leaving university, I worked. I was initially trained on the Canberra Times, I also worked in Britain on two newspapers there, a regional newspaper, the Birmingham Post, and also on the Evening Standard. which in both places I learned a lot about journalism. But when we returned to Australia, my wife and I, we had the travel bug. And my wife saw an advertisement for diplomatic trainees and said, why don't you apply for those, for that? You have to be under 26 to apply. And I was still under 26 at the time, so I applied and got in. And at the end of that year, they sent me off to Cairo to study Arabic for 2 years. So I lived in Cairo for the life of a student, in a sense, with my wife, and we had a young child at that point, and loved Cairo. I found it utterly fascinating. Then went on to a posting in Saudi Arabia, and after various stints back in Australia, I had postings in Syria, in Moscow as well, and also in Lebanon before going to the Office of National Assessments, as you mentioned, where I really had about 15 years of a career there. But an interesting thing about the Middle East when I first got there in 1977 was I knew very little about it. In fact, at the time, I obviously read the histories of it and that sort of thing. But you've really got to live in the country to absorb it. And I was studying Arabic and going through the headlines in Al Ahram newspaper with my tutor. And I thought I'd got something wrong. And I said, this headline talks about our victory in 1973. And I said, but Egypt didn't win in 1973. It was more like a draw, wasn't it? And my tutor got very, who was Egyptian, got very upset and said, no, we won. We won. And I decided not to take that any further because it was a very emotional issue. And so we left it at that. But it became clear to me in the course of that year, that was 1977, that Sadat was able to claim.
This is Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt.
Anwar Sadat, yes, the president, was able to claim 1973 as a victory because on the basis of that victory, he could then make his outreach to Israel, go to Jerusalem in 1977 and eventually sign a peace agreement with Israel, but having restored Egyptian pride, which it did. I mean, some friends of mine who were living in Israel at the time said that the Israelis were really taken by surprise and were really worried that this time the Egyptians and the Syrians could actually have done for them.
And that was a really significant moment, wasn't it, at the time? I mean, that was a big breakthrough for Israel to have this peace, to have this recognition and this peace agreement.
Exactly. I mean, having a peace agreement with Israel, with Egypt, between Israel and Egypt, really was a huge strategic win for Israel because it meant that the biggest Arab state with the biggest army, the largest population, was suddenly taken out of the equation. The Egyptians had very good reason to want to maintain that peace. And one of the reasons, of course, was that they had decided to throw over their relationship with the Soviet Union in the early 70s and instead turn to the United States, for which the United States rewarded them richly. They were given enormous amounts of aid, both civil and military, by the United States, but all of it intended to keep the peace treaty in place. And so it was a great victory for Israel in that sense, because at that stage, none of the other states were likely to be able to defeat Israel together or on their own.
And of course, it didn't play well for Anwar Sadat in the end, did it? He was assassinated.
That's right.
And of course, much later on, Yitzhak Rabin in Israel was assassinated, very often for, I mean, I know they're different incidents relating to different negotiations, but pretty clearly shows the danger that even people who are trying to make progress, leaders that make progress in these long-running conflicts, can end up being taken down by extremists on their own side.
Yes. I mean, the death of both leaders, Anwar Sadat and Yitzhak Rabin in 1995, I think it was.
Yeah.
Both of those were tragedies, obviously at a personal level for them, but also for the processes that they were sponsoring.
Yes.
If Yitzhak Rabin had lived, and he had been a hardliner, although in today's terms he probably wouldn't be described as being as hard as, say, Netanyahu is, Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel. But if Yitzhak Rabin had lived, the peace process at that point could possibly have gone forward. And there could well have been peace established with the Palestinians at that stage.
Yeah, I think Yasser Arafat said in the aftermath of that, he said, "Where, you know, who do I negotiate with now?"
Yes.
And negotiation obviously is a precursor to it's fundamental to the idea of actually getting to a peaceful settlement. And we can talk a bit about negotiations that are going on now, how they're going on, whether there's any chance for them. Through our conversations in the lead up to this discussion, I think it's fair to say even more pessimistic than I am and than many people are about the situation, the current situation in the war between Hamas and Israel. Why is that? I mean, my feeling is just by way of making a comparison, my feeling is that obviously it's an extremely grim situation, unimaginably grim. Mm. Yet there is, it seems to me, more momentum in the international community, more resolve in the international community now to try and do something decisive in this regard. We see Lord Cameron, David Cameron, former Prime Minister of Britain, now Foreign Minister, and people like him, and we see Macron in France, they're both talking about giving the Palestinians a horizon, something to hope for, mm-hmm. something to believe is possible as a way of putting some energy and some credibility into negotiations. But this is all toward the idea of Palestinian statehood, which is part of the much talked about but completely undelivered two-state plan, two-state solution, a Palestinian state alongside an Israeli state. You think that's just fanciful?
I think there are several reasons. I mean, unfortunately, I've been a pessimist in the Middle East for a very long time.
And you keep being proven right.
I keep being proven right, yes. What's the old story? A pessimist is an optimist who's been mugged by reality or something like that.
Yeah, there's plenty of that going on there.
But the point is, I've lived in the Middle East and I've visited every country in the Middle East. And it's a very tough neighbourhood, a very rough neighbourhood. And it produces some very hard-line people. There's no doubt about that. I think the problem with any peace negotiations between Israel and any Palestinian entity, be it led by the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank or in some way with Hamas, is that there's no trust. No. Mm. After the attacks by Hamas, which, as you rightly said, were absolutely horrific on October the 7th, even Israelis who had hopes of peace were perhaps prepared to consider some form of two-state solution, are now much harder line on that. I saw some figures yesterday that indicated that only about 25% of Israelis think that negotiations with Palestinians are even worthwhile at this point. It will take a long time to restore that trust. It may be able to be restored. I certainly hope it can. The other part of the problem is that a two-state solution requires space for the Palestinian state. Now, clearly Gaza in itself isn't large enough. But neither at this stage is the West Bank, simply because of the number of Israeli settlements that have gone there. Well, when I first went...
And that's before you get to the contiguity problem, if I could put it like that. Yeah. Well, there is no those two places are separated by Israel itself.
Yeah, I think that I've looked at some possible solutions to that. That could be done by a Palestinians-only road or something like that. I mean, essentially Israel giving up the a small corridor to enable the two states the two sides to be linked. I mean, that's one of the possibilities. Mm. It's never been actually sort of formally sort of sorted out and discussed at this stage.
But it would be open to being, if this isn't a contradiction in terms, it would be open to being closed, that is vulnerable to Israel simply closing it separate the two territories, the two parts of that state.
Oh, exactly, exactly. I mean, and I think there are very few Israelis, very, very few, who would not accept the point that Prime Minister Netanyahu has made that Israel really has to control militarily the whole area from the Jordan River in the east right across to the Mediterranean. that there really is no other way that Israel can feel secure. I mean, one can understand that among Israelis. But the big problem is that in the West Bank itself, there is now so little land that's left, which could form the basis of a Palestinian state. The best parts of it have been taken over by Israeli settlements. Mm. Some of them are huge.
Yeah, I know. When you see them, they are, and they occupy hilltops. They've, in many cases, monopolised the available water. Of course, water is a very scarce resource in that part of the world.
Exactly.
And, yes, it's a real problem. There has been some talk of the idea of land swaps, of territory swaps, of perhaps increasing the geographical size of the West Bank to take account of that, or
usually that comes down to taking a bit of the Negev Desert and making that part,
which is that part down near Egypt that we were talking about before, near the border with Egypt.
But it's not very attractive land.
No, I mean it's called desert.
It's not called a desert. I mean it's not fully desert. It's an area where, by comparison with the rest of the West Bank and the rest of Israel, which I mean, you've been there, it's a beautiful country.
It is.
It's really quite desolate and is not attractive land. And the perspective of the Palestinians, of course, is that all of it was theirs at one stage. And they say, you know, why should we not get it all back? Now, clearly that's totally unrealistic at this point. I mean, if I just might digress at this point to make a point, I taught at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies a course on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the second half of 2022, which I found very interesting because I had to go right back to the start of the growth of Zionism in the 19th century and take it right through the British Mandate, Balfour Declaration, etc., but through to the 1947 petition plan that the UN General Assembly drew up. Now, if you look at that petition plan, it was a basis for negotiations at that stage. But unfortunately for the Palestinians, their leadership at the time ruled it out entirely. They said, no, we won't accept that. We used to have all of the land. We want nothing less than all of the land back.
Because it involved villages, towns, farming areas and so forth, people being moved off. I mean, Palestinians,
that's right? So a separate Palestinian state and a separate Israeli state or Jewish state, as it was called at that time. It wasn't Israel. Didn't have the name at that stage. But the Jewish representatives said, yes, please, we'll take that. And because there was no agreement, the British were determined to end their mandate, and they ended their mandate on the 14th of, I believe it was the 14th, might have been the 15th of May, 1948, and they just were prepared to get out of that stage. But at that stage, the war started because the Arab states all came in supporting the Palestinians. And it took Israel several months to win that war. It was the War of Independence.
So that
eventually won.
That war came on the back of what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe.
Well, the Nakba was result of the war when Palestinians were driven out of their ancestral homes. I mean, many of them still got their keys. Many went to Lebanon. Mm. A lot went to Jordan. Some even went to Egypt. There was a very large number of Palestinians, possibly about 700,000, that were driven out of their ancestral home in what was British Mandate Palestine. And they've always wanted to come back and have never been able to come back. And even under a full peace agreement, that's one of the contentious issues. Mm. It's most unlikely that any of them will be allowed to come back. And when I was working in Syria and in Lebanon, I used to go to Palestinian encampments and meet Palestinians there. And many of them still had the keys to their homes in Israel.
And you can understand that. You can understand that attachment
and that
feeling of a great wrong having been done them trying to keep alive that hope of justice being done in their case.
Absolutely.
One of the ideas I've heard talked about, and I don't know how much currency this has or whether it is anything that could actually be workable. It sounds on the face of it kind of unworkable, as part of any sort of agreement, if it could be reached and if it could contain other sufficient positive things, that the right of those returnees be recognised but not exercised.
Mm.
Have you heard about that sort of idea?
And they could be given compensation in some way.
Yeah.
Yes, I've heard that as being one of the many issues. I mean, some of the some brilliant minds have worked on this. It's almost like a Rubik's Cube. You can just sort of come up with a lot of ideas. And, I mean, there was a great deal of hope in the early 1990s, of course, at the time, after the Oslo Accords were signed.
Yeah, so this is when Rabin and Arafat are actually having those.
They shook hands.
Yes, and Bill Clinton's leading those negotiations.
And up to Rabin's death, it really looked quite possible. But after that, it really started to fall apart. And we had the Intifada, second Intifada, which started in the year 2000. And totally destroyed the Oslo Accords.
For those people who don't know, Intifada, I think it means uprising.
Uprising, yes.
And can you just explain sort of what it was? Because we hear about the first and the second Intifada and the talk of a third Intifada.
Well, it was something which in many ways hurt the Palestinians more than the Israelis, because the Israelis were able to led to the walling off of many parts of the Israeli predominated
inhabited areas. West Bank,
But essentially it was a mass strike accompanied by violence. There was stone throwing. There were attacks on individual Israelis. There were a lot of people killed on both sides. It wasn't outright war, but it made everybody feel very uncomfortable. There was this sense that almost anywhere that you went near the border with between Israel and the Palestinian occupied areas was very dangerous. And certainly many settlers were killed in the course of that too.
Mm.
As I said, quite a large number of Palestinians were killed, but it did hurt them much more. Interestingly, one of the people who is often seen as a potential Palestinian negotiator, a man by the name of Marwan Barghouti, was put in jail during the time of the first Intifada from 87 to 93, because he actually was found guilty of killing some Israelis. And in fact, my general understanding is that Hamas, in calling for the release of prisoners that Israel holds, wants to include Barghouti among them. I don't know the rights and wrongs of what Barghouti did, but he is certainly seen in the opinion polls as someone who could unite and lead the Palestinians and would be capable of coming to some sort of long-term settlement with the Palestinians if he were given a chance.
It's really interesting.
It's most unlikely it will happen, though.
One can feel the parallels there with some others. I'm thinking Nelson Mandela, for example, jailed as an ANC terrorist at the time, who spends a long time in prison and emerges to lead his country back to reunification, but his own side to a peaceful settlement, which makes me think, and I'm not the first person to note this, that in our lifetimes we've seen some of these intractable problems. I think South Africa as one example, the Northern Irish problem as another one, the Troubles.
Mm.
We've seen these things taken to a new stage, to a stage of some sort of something approximating resolution, not without some problems in both cases, I think it's fair to say. We see no progress in the Middle East on this between Israel and Palestine. It's like the fundamental injustices felt by both sides from the very beginning continue to frame it all the way through. And there have been, as you've just noted, there have been moments where progress has looked possible, where leaders have emerged who have that as their commitment. But we don't see any leaders at the moment on either side who seem capable of or committed to that. We just see them further apart than ever.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the real tragedy of the 1947 partition plan was that if the Palestinians had accepted their half loaf that they were offered, and they did see it as being half a loaf, they wouldn't have had a state.
Yes.
There would be a recognized physical state that they would have, and it was on some good land. So it's a great pity that their leaders at the time did not accept that. And that really has set the parameters for the conflict since then.
You can understand their thinking had they known what would occur. I mean, their view was, why should we give away half our country? That was their view. The Israelis had a view that they had historical links to, or the Jewish people had historical links to that land as well. These things were recognised. Now we look at that and think, well, that could have avoided a whole lot of suffering, a whole lot of pain, a whole lot of, you know, violence that has really beset the world ever since and certainly framed that whole region.
And that's the difference with Northern Ireland, of course, that the point is that it wasn't contested land as such. It was contested politics. It was who should rule over that Northern Ireland stretch of land. And that's what we hope being substantially resolved now.
Yeah, well, it's certainly been moved. It's much more peaceful than it used to be. I mean, essentially there's no state of war going on. There is the odd thing that you hear about, but there's even now a Sinn Féin leader in Northern Ireland, which is remarkable.
Amazing.
And she has spoken as First Minister in quite conciliatory terms about the other side. It does give some hope, but of course all of these circumstances are sui generis. They all have their own particular characteristics and you can't generalise about them. Let's just take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to ask you a bit more about Hamas.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Ian Parmeter about the disaster that is the Middle East. I want to ask you in a moment about one of the latest developments, which is this declaration by Israel rejecting international pressure, any internationally imposed moves towards a two-state solution or whatever, but also about the declaration of March 10 as a deadline for Hamas to return all hostages, including the remains of deceased hostages. We'll come to that in a moment, but something you said in the first half that I wanted to just get your view on as well, and I know this is entirely speculative, but what do you think, as an expert, someone who's studied the region for a long time, what do you think the strategic thinking of Hamas was to launch the October 7 attack?
I've wondered about that. I mean, they've never actually given a manifesto as to what they were doing, although I think they had a couple of hopes in mind. The operation, the terrorist attack, and it was a terrorism attack, they called Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Now, Al-Aqsa, of course, is the mosque in Jerusalem, the third holiest place in Islam.
Otherwise known as the Temple Mount by Israelis.
The Temple Mount by Israelis, that's right. And it's just below the wall where Israelis, Jews pray. But the point is that they were clearly trying to draw Islamic opinion on their behalf when they did it. They also, I think, were hoping that they might get a more general uprising, that they might get the West Bank to come up and rise up with them at the same time.
And possibly other regional players, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon?
Well, they did hope that Hezbollah would definitely get involved, undoubtedly. I don't think they thought anything about the Houthis at that stage.
No.
But the
who turned out to be the most enthusiastic.
Exactly.
Opportunists.
Which is ironical, but I can get back to Hezbollah a bit later. But the point is that they've now got the Palestinian-Israeli issue back at the top of the Middle East agenda.
They have, yeah.
And that, I think, was a major part of what they had in, they wanted to do. They were very much aware that Prime Minister Netanyahu was very successful at making peace agreements with individual Arab states. Under the Abraham Accords, he'd made them with the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. And he was indicating he wanted to make further peace agreements. One with Saudi Arabia was just around the corner.
Yeah.
The Saudis had indicated that they were prepared to make a peace agreement with Israel. And for the Saudis and Israelis, that would be a match made in heaven, because the Saudis will get Israeli technical cooperation and the Saudis would have the money. So it could work very well.
Mm.
Now, that's off the table.
Well, it's been put on hold, hasn't it?
It's been put on hold. It's been put on hold. But it's going to be a while before the Saudis can come.
Could be on hold for a long time. Come back to it.
Because they, even though it's a monarchy, they do have to think about the views of their own population.
Yeah.
So I think they wanted to stymie all of that. And essentially, the Israelis gave them the opportunity, because at the end of a six-day holiday, the Sukkot holiday, the Netanyahu government was far more concerned with protecting settlers in the West Bank. So that was why it took so long for the Israeli military to get down to southern Israel to basically react against the attack that Hamas was carrying out.
And does that explain, I hasten to add here, I'm not suggesting this is an excuse. I'm just wondering whether that long period of time between when they breached the border between the Gaza Strip and Israel and they went into those kibbutzes, they engaged in the most appalling violence, the most appalling sexual violence and misogyny and a murder and rape spree can be described as nothing else. Was that always the intention? Was it designed to be sort of to maximally provoke the Israelis into a response? I mean, because you can sort of join the dots and look at a lot of that. Or was it actually opportunistic? That is, it took the Israeli Defense Forces so long to contest this action that the killing spree just went on for a long time.
That's a particularly good question. I mean, clearly the fact that the Israeli Defense Forces took so long to get to the scene of the outrages was part of the reason that they went on for so long for. But something I have heard, and, you know, I've discussed it with a lot of people who have relatives in the West Bank and in Gaza, it was an operation that in itself was not meant to be as widespread as that. It was meant to be a more limited operation to just kidnap some Israeli soldiers and get them back, because it had such success with the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. But others, when the breaches were made, when the fence was blown up, others came through, and a lot of the attacks were carried out by others without the full authorization of Hamas. Now, I don't know if that's true. I must emphasize that. But that is one of the accounts that I've heard, that it was one of these things that got quite out of hand and wasn't meant to be quite as bad as it was. It would have been bad anyway, but not necessarily as bad as that. Now,
I mean, they went into a music festival and just were killing people indiscriminately.
Yes, that's right. And the music festival was right down there too. They would have known about that. The other reality is that Hamas, and because there are other Palestinian groups in Gaza as well. You've got Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which vies with Hamas for some sort of authority in Gaza as well. And it is a very hard-line group in addition. But the Israelis, just to put this in context, the Israelis had been trying a strategy which appeared to be working well of giving work permits to Gazans to come and work in Israel. Now, there's a big advantage in doing that. If the Gazans went and worked in Israel, they were paid a good wage. They could come back and support their families well in Gaza itself. This is well before October the 7th, of course. But as well as that, it provided an incentive for Hamas to keep not so much the peace, but what in Arabic they call hudna, which means quiet. And just basically to not be causing problems for the Israelis. Now, there were still some rockets that went back and forth, and there was an outbreak of fighting in 2021. But by and large, the idea of trying to get an incentive for the Palestinians, for the Gazans, to keep some sort of peace was there. Now, that's gone completely. But the Israelis actually thought it was working. And they thought that at this stage, Hamas is probably quiet. And that was why it appears that Netanyahu himself is saying he was never told that there was a risk that there could be an outbreak by Hamas at some point in the near future, whereas his own intelligence and military people were reportedly telling him, we don't know when, we don't know where, but we know they're planning something. So keep your eye on Gaza.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, two of the hardliners, the ultra-nationalists in Netanyahu's government, you know, who are sort of almost personally, along with Netanyahu, responsible for that definition of the current government as the most right-wing in Israeli history, they were very, very happy to be kind of fostering as much division. And there was a lot of friction in the occupied West Bank as a result of their policies. Ben-Gvir is the security minister, actually handing out weapons to settlers to conduct whatever violence they were conducting against Palestinians in what is actually meant to be the future Palestinian state. The whole thing has just been such a disaster and a real reflection, as you say, on where Israel's priorities were. Very ideological and, you know, conducted with a great deal of sort of religious zeal in the occupied territories. And meanwhile, they were taken completely by surprise by something they should not have been surprised by.
No. And there's no doubt that as soon as there's some sort of long-term break in this fighting, whenever it might be, there will be a major inquiry into the intelligence failure, or what went wrong. I mean, not just the intelligence, but the governance failure.
Yeah, and Bibi Netanyahu knows this, of course, which is one of the reasons why, and not only does he not really want this war to stop, because that's when that inquiry will start, as will, in fact, he be facing criminal charges, fraud charges.
That's right.
Unrelated to that. But also, I suppose he figures that absolute victory, which is the sort of terminology he's using, the only outcome of this is Israel's absolute victory. He's hoping that that, if it is literally absolute, that that would be his ticket out of those sort of problems.
Exactly. The longer it goes on, the better chance there is that something that he can call victory will emerge. I would suggest that such a victory could be the killing or capturing of Yahya Sinwar and also Mohammed Deif.
So this is the leadership of Hamas.
The two leaders of Hamas, yes. Mm. If he could get rid of those, he can say he's decapitated them. Now, the big question arises then of where it all goes from there. One of the consequences of the Hamas attack and of the Israeli counterattack, of course, the Israeli, you know, very strong attack on Gaza, has been that opinion polling in the West Bank, where Hamas really was meant to have fairly low opinion ratings, and before October the 7th, it was only about 12%. It's gone up to 44%.
So among Palestinians who are now quite dispirited with the Palestinian Authority, which is the government in the West Bank, I say government in a very attenuated way because it has very limited authority.
Yes.
And very limited sovereignty, if any at all. Palestinians are now more enthusiastic about Hamas, even though Hamas has invited this disaster on its own people.
Yeah. Well, that often happens. And, I mean, this goes way back to I was reading a piece by Lawrence Durrell, the author of the Alexandria Quartet, but he at one stage was working in Cyprus at the time of uprisings among the Cypriot independence movements. And he explains then that one of the tactics of the people behind the uprising was to carry out an outrage in trying to get the British to come and
overreact.
And overreact. Mm. And that, of course, got them more recruits. And this is sort of a similar to what Hamas is now doing.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at the scale of the Israeli reaction, 30,000 killed in a space of 4 months, getting on to five, one of the certain outcomes of this will be that the hatred for Israel among Palestinians will increase even more.
And the irony of that is that this is supposedly done, outwardly done, to protect Israel's security, but it's probably guaranteeing an ongoing escalated threat to Israel's security as well.
Exactly.
Into the future.
Now you see why I'm pessimistic.
Yeah, I do. Let's, before we come back to what I said, we'd mention this deadline and so forth, let's just quickly touch on where the Americans are with all of this, because America has been so pivotal to support for Israel, the relationship, the financial aid, the arms aid, which is still flowing to Israel. And yet the Americans turn out to have very little sway over Netanyahu in this. You can see the frustration. Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, has been there five or six times now on shuttle diplomacy. There have been all kinds of attempts at sort of a counseling restraint on Netanyahu. Biden's had a number of conversations with him, reportedly referred to him, Netanyahu, that is, as an arsehole recently. I think it might have been asshole. And you can understand the frustration, but the Americans have no real leverage here.
No, you're absolutely right. And Netanyahu is extremely good at leveraging American politics to work in his favor. Netanyahu and Obama had a totally poisonous relationship. They loathed each other. And Obama tried to put pressure on Israel to reduce settlement building in the West Bank, because Obama could see that it was just destroying the prospects for any sort of Palestinian state. And he had no success whatsoever. And in fact, in 2015, I think, it might have been 2016, but certainly during Obama's term, the most extraordinary thing occurred with Netanyahu making a visit to the US, speaking to a joint session of the Republican-controlled Congress, and not even calling on the President of the United States.
Mm.
It was just amazing. And of course, being given a standing ovation by the Congress.
By Republicans, yeah. Now, let's go to this deadline that's been announced. It's quite curious, actually. There's a number of things you could say about it. So the Israelis have said to Hamas, give us all our hostages back, including the remains of those who are no longer alive, by March 10, which is the start of Ramadan, or you will face the ground invasion in Rafah that we've been talking about. Israel has not specifically said that it will then not invade afterwards. It's just left that open as far as I can tell. And bearing in mind what we were just discussing about Netanyahu, there seems no likelihood that he would decide not to go after the Hamas leadership, you know, to continue to do so. And we've seen what that involves. Basically, it involves a logic of saying they're in tunnels underneath you, therefore you don't count. Effectively, that's the message to Palestinian civilians. And there's been no restraint showed in hospitals and mosques and all kinds of other things. You've got this declaration. I suppose there's a few things you can say about it. One is, presumably it means there won't be a ground invasion between now and March 10. Unless there's a definitive declaration from Hamas that will not be agreed to under any circumstances. And what else does it tell us?
Well, I think that declaration was given by Gantz, not Netanyahu.
Right.
And Gantz
is Benny Gantz.
Yeah. He's not in Likud. He's the leader of another party, but he's part of the war cabinet.
And he's a very decorated soldier, highly regarded.
Yes, former head of the former chief of staff of the IDF.
Yeah.
He has cred as far as the Israeli public is concerned. And he's also seen by the West, if you like, and also among Palestinians as someone that, in a sense, is not as rigid, not as hard line.
Not mad.
Not mad. I mean, not like but he's not in the government as such.
Mm. But he is in this war cabinet.
He's in the war cabinet, but not in the government. Mm. So it gives it a bit of added impetus, saying this isn't just Netanyahu and Ben Gavir and Smotrich who are saying this. This is the more moderate member of the war cabinet. And what it does is it gives credibility to the likelihood that Israel will go in and will essentially probably have a lot of civilian casualties unless they're able to be moved out of the Rafah area. But I doubt that they can be in that time. But they do have something like, what are we now? We're the 20th, aren't we? Probably got 3 weeks in which the various international agencies can try to move them out of there. But there's the question, where do they go as well? Because there's nowhere to live.
And how do you move them without moving the leadership?
Yes. Well, you can move everybody who's above ground, but nobody who's below ground. Where that actually gets them is not certain at this point.
So is there some international messaging going on here? Yes. Does it reflect the reality that Israel understands it's under more international pressure than it has been probably ever before?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, it takes a lot to put really serious pressure on Netanyahu. But there is now a great deal of international pressure. We've had the three-way statement by the Prime Ministers of Australia, Canada and New Zealand, which is most unusual. I've never seen a statement of that sort on a foreign policy issue in this way. Also, it's very clear that the United States is putting a lot of pressure on Israel. I think that someone like Gantz, probably within the War Cabinet, said, well, look, we've got to take some note of this. Mm. And this actually is quite a clever ploy in many ways, because they're saying, we don't want to have any more civilian casualties. We want all civilians out of here, and we're now giving you essentially 3 weeks to do it. But we will go in definitely at that point. But what they're not promising is what Hamas has demanded with the demands, which Netanyahu has called delusional, is an undertaking that the Israeli forces will then leave Gaza and will not keep attacking Gaza. Netanyahu won't do that, and he really can't, because his own cabinet won't let him do it.
Mm.
They're as hardline as he is. His cabinet would break up, they'd have to have new elections, and Netanyahu is extremely unpopular at the moment, has only about a 15% popularity rating. He would almost certainly lose an election, be unable to form a coalition government. I mean, Israeli politics is a study in itself, because it takes only 3.5%, or about that, for a party to get representation in the Knesset. A party can be one or two people, but if they've got 3.5%, they're represented there. So it means that you can never have any one party with more than 60 seats in the Knesset, with more than 50%. So no government is going to be, a government which has got its own principles. It's going to have to dilute those principles to work with other parties. It's an unusual situation that we face in Israel.
But yes, you could say that. Just in a couple of minutes we got left, talk to me about the negotiations, because it seems to me that's a highly problematic process. This is negotiations for a ceasefire that the Americans have eventually been pushing for, and as you just noted, Australia and other countries support. There have been attempts to reach some sort of agreement for humanitarian ceasefires in the past. How do those negotiations actually work? I mean, how do you negotiate with Hamas if Hamas isn't at the table? So there's sort of proxies or Qataris or someone negotiating on their behalf. But how does the messaging happen between them and Hamas without revealing the location of that Hamas leadership, which the Israelis, of course, would dearly like to know?
Yeah, the politics of negotiations between parties that won't talk with each other is obviously very complicated. I mean, when the US talks with Iran, when they were trying to reestablish the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear agreement, the negotiations took place in Qatar, in Doha, but the Americans and the Iranians were in separate rooms. They weren't meeting together. Now, exactly how it's working in Egypt and when it takes place in Qatar, I don't know. And it's being done by the Hamas representatives who live in Qatar.
Mm.
They actually go there. And it's being conducted essentially by the head of Mossad with the head of CIA there as well, essentially trying to work together on these things. But there probably are other Israeli negotiators there. And the Israelis have got some very good, skilled negotiators. Now, whether they all sit down together and talk, I don't know. I haven't seen pictures of this happening, so I'm afraid I can't make a comment there. But the message is getting through. There are clearly messages getting passed. Now,
one imagines if the Israelis knew, if there was signal intelligence about any sort of dialogue between Hamas leadership and those negotiators, the Israelis would be onto that very quickly.
Well, presumably, yes. Exactly how they get Yahya Sinwar's okay.
Imprimatur to do anything at all.
Is unclear, but somehow or other they actually do get it. But getting back to this deadline itself, I find it, I think it's most unlikely that Hamas will simply say, okay, we'll release all the hostages now, you know, or, you know, on the 10th. I think it's more likely they'll make a partial offer, an offer to release half, maybe three quarters. See, they've got about 139. How many are still alive? We don't know. Mm. But they've still got quite a lot. And so there's the scope for the Hamas to come up with a counteroffer is there. They've not come up with it as yet, but I suspect there will be counteroffers back and forth. Now, interestingly, it seems to me that the fact that Benny Gantz has actually made the offer indicates to me that there probably isn't much room for negotiation. I think that, in fact, if Hamas doesn't give back all the hostages by the 10th, the Israelis will go in.
So it's just another way of saying we're going in on or after, immediately after March 10th.
But we warned the international community and we took note.
And you can see we were being reasonable. We were trying to get our people out. We've done everything we can. We've given them all this extra time didn't have to. Yeah. And they have defied us, so we're going in.
I mean, we'll have to see what happens in 3 weeks. But and 3 weeks, as I can assure you, is a very long time in the Middle East. But I suspect they're simply clearing their lines, indicating the international community, you know, get off our backs. We're doing our best here. And, you know, if we can get all our hostages back, we can modify our plans. But they haven't said what they'll do instead. That's the issue.
Yes. Well, I hope that you've enjoyed or learned as much as I have in having this chat with Ian Palmer. Ian, thanks so much for being on Democracy Sausage.
You're welcome.
It's great to have scholars like you at ANU and who can really unpick these things and know the history so well and speak with such authority and such firsthand knowledge of the region. We all just hope, we hope rather than expect, that there will be some sort of improvement in this appalling situation in the Middle East. That's Democracy Sausage for this week. We'll talk to you again next week. Till then, bye for now.